Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Giovanni Sardagna, Investor Relations Director of Tenaris, and well, most of you already know me, so I will be your reference contact for any additional information you might need on Tenaris in the future. We are very happy to be back here in New York at the Guggenheim after last year's presentation in London. Before we start, I would like to start with a very quick notice on safety. So please take a look to the nearest emergency exit to you. We have four emergency exits in the theater. There are two emergency exits on the back and another two here in the behind the stage, actually on each side of the screen. First of all, I have to remind you that during this presentation, we will be discussing forward-looking information, and our actual results may vary from those we express during this event. As most of you might have noticed, we have changed our Investor Day format this year. This year, we will have a presentation that will be shared between our Chairman and CEO, Paolo Rocca, and the rest of the top management team. The idea was to better introduce most of the management team to you all. After the presentation, without any coffee break, because we are running short of time, we will have a question and answer session during which Paolo and the management will answer to your questions. And after the Q&A, we will go back to the lobby of the museum where we will have lunch. And for those of you who have time and wish to stay, there is also going to be a guided tour of the exhibition here at the Guggenheim, Zero Countdown to Tomorrow. Now, let me quickly introduce the management team here with us today. Paolo Rocca, our Chairman and CEO. Germán Curá, Head of our North American Operations. Guillermo Vogel, Vice President of Finance and member of our Board of Directors, and our expert on Mexico. Javier Martínez-Álvarez, Head of our Southern Cone Operation. Gabriel Podskubka, Head of our Eastern Hemisphere Operation. Luca Zanotti, Head of European Operation, and our Chief Financial Officer, Edgardo Calvo. So I think I said all I had to say, and I will ask Paolo to start with the presentation. Thank you again, and enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, Giovanni, for your presentation. Well, thank you to everybody for coming, participating in our Investor Day. We really appreciate very much your presence and the opportunity to present what we are doing. But in this case, in this Investor Day, it's a pleasure for me to have the chance to present and to promote interaction between yourself and a group of our top executives that are leading Tenaris in different parts of the world. Here you have represented most of our executive committee. We don't have here the functional director and two regions, the Andean region and Brazilian operation that are not represented here, but all of the rest of the world is here. And also, in this moment, let's say there are in Andean region, we have engine like Venezuela that are engine for Tenaris that in this moment are basically idle. So we are not doing so much in that area. And in Brazil, to some extent also, is a moment in which the engine of Brazil during this year is not particularly strong, but even if it could be so, and we expect to be so back in 2015. So it's an opportunity to listen to executive in Tenaris and to interact with them. I will start with some comment on some of the key drivers, as usual, for Tenaris. These are interesting times for the oil industry and also for the economy of the world. I'm not very steady business as usual time. When we look at the oil prices and this is in the oil business, that is an important driver for us. It's clear that we are seeing in this moment an adjustment in price compared to what we see here in our graph. We're not, let's say, the key speaker or someone that could know so much about the oil, but we see how the company are evaluating the situation and reacting. From my point of view, this situation is the result of different factors. From the point of view of the demand, it's clear that there is a sense of slow motion in some part of the world, and for sure, from the point of view of demand, the situation of China is very relevant. It's clear that China is slowing down its growth. The growth of the industrial production went down from 10% in the last years, 3-4 years ago, to the 7.97, probably heading to a lower level of growth. The country in itself is also heading for a lower level of growth, still respectable, around 7%, but going slightly low. We see this, I would say, a slowdown of the economy, a slowdown of the industrial sector of China, and a change in the driver of investment. For instance, if we look at this from the point of view of steel, this is very noticeable. Steel demand in China was coming at more than 10% for a while, then went down to 3.8% last year. Now in the coming year it's forecasted at 1%, even lower than 1% in the coming years. This is important. It means that the intensity of steel demand, the intensity of infrastructure, the intensity of industrial demand in China is lower than before, and the intensity of investment in the data sector also. This has a consequence on demand for oil. There is a perception that demand of oil could go down to some extent. But still, if you look at the number, you see that China is adding this year around 400, is importing 400,000 barrels more than last year. Still, the pace of growth of consumption in China is pretty high and will stay there. So I don't see so much demand impact from this. Europe is in a similar situation, but I don't think that the fundamentals of this change in the expectation of price are coming from demand. I think they're coming from the supply side. In the last years, shales has added a substantial volume of production, and this is changing equilibrium on the supply side for oil. I'm coming back from a visit to all of our clients in Saudi Arabia in the Gulf. There is a perception that Saudi are coping with this new order that is being created after many years of increase in the production of shales, change of equilibrium in volumes, and change of equilibrium also in quality of oil. The relation between the light Brent or Louisiana and so on, and the more heavy oil, and these are also influencing the need to some repositioning there. We do not know if this is something that will last until November, the OPEC meeting is something that will, is an internal discussion within OPEC, or maybe is something that has a more medium-term objective of repositioning some of the supply in the Gulf. But for sure, something of this is underway. This is changing the expectation, is entering into the forecast and the decision that the oil company are taking. We see a reduction in the capex in different projects compared to December last year. If we look at what we see today, there is clearly a reduction. This is focused on the international oil company, the national the independent oil company, while the national oil company, at least in our perception, are maintaining the program in different parts of the world. If we look at, let's say, where this is affecting projects that are important for Tenaris, I would say that some of the marginal heavy oil projects in Canada and in other parts of the world are either postponed or slowed down. To some extent, the investment there is reduced. The oil company are seeing a reduction in their cash flow. They react. In the offshore, we do not see projects that are underway, that are stopped, but we see postponement of the startup of the high cash demanding phase of their operation. So we see projects, especially when in areas that are relatively marginal, in which the return could be possibly lower in this condition, that are postponed or delayed. This has an impact and will have an impact on our position and in the market of our products. The big question is concerning shales. Shales are the most pipe-intensive operation, and in this moment are driven by oil drilling. This is the question. With the price of Brent stabilized around between 80 and 90, this is the level that, in my perception, could be a level that Saudi and the rest of the operator, the main operator, may have in mind in the medium term. We will have to see how repositioning will occur in the shale environment. If there will be a reduction in some of the less profitable drilling and the investment. But basically, I would say the fundamentals of the industry for oil, in our view, are not changed. China is continuously growing in spite of reduction of it. Europe, gradually we should expect recovery driven by more active monetary policy at some point over time. And the United States should also have a recovery. So in the end, from my point of view, on the demand side, we can expect a driver for demand of oil. And the depletion is very strong. The depletion in shales is particularly strong. So in the end, the combined effect of depletion and demand and consumption increase should drive increased demand, not very different from our previous forecast. Even if in the short term, we see a postponement or reduction of projects. When we look at the other side of the slide, we look at the gas. In the gas, the situation didn't change so much. Even if you see, apart from the seasonally driven reduction in the price of spot LNG, this is recovering now in face of the winter. When I think about the Russia dispute and the crisis opening that part of the world, I see also the relevance of shift into clean energy, and these drivers for gas are there. To some extent, will continuously drive demand for gas. We do not see big change. What we have seen has been some delay in LNG project in the less profitable situation. Some of these projects could go in difficulties or in problem when the price of LNG goes beyond 14, beyond 13 or 12. But at this level, we expect that the demand for LNG and the supply will accompany from the U.S., from other places in the world over time. So this didn't change so much. Now, how this environment may affect our market. This is what happened up to now. Overall OCTG demand increased up to 17 million tons in 2014. This is our expectation. You see here that a leveling of the apparent demand. Part of this leveling is due to the stocking and destocking of Saudi. The destocking of Saudi has an impact, and that's an impact especially on our market, which is more the premium-oriented specialty pipe market. This has an impact in these 2 years, in 2013, in which we can estimate an over-demand driven by stocking of Saudi, and here we have some lower than consumption demand driven by the destocking in Saudi. This happened in the past, but what we see is that the level of consumption, drilling, and program of the Gulf, and Gabriel Podskubka will comment on this, are very steady and very strong. Saudi arrived to 200 rigs in the past weeks. They are heading for a further increase in the rigs, and the gas is driving investment in the Middle East. In our view, this will not stop. Even if we look at the sales, the destocking is really affecting this quarter, the next quarter. We will affect a period of time, but not the fundamental of this. When we look at what's happening this year, the premium demand has grown at 10% per year. API, the more simple product, 5%. Will this change in the future? In our view, no. Even if the trend may be affected in the short term by the delay of project, we expect that the rate of growth of the two markets will continue to be very different. The projects that are coming under the attention of the oil company are complex. Everywhere in the world, in our international arena, for sure. And so this will remain so. There will be a shale demand growth that has been at 33% per year in the past. In my view, this will be affected, and Herman will comment on this, with a price of WTE in the range of $80, with excess production, excess availability of light crude in the area of the Gulf, to some extent, shale should be affected, and we may see in the medium term some rigs getting out from this, but we will see. Kerman will extend on this. How is the competitive environment? Competitive environment in our world is clearly quite aggressive. There is overcapacity in our world. China has a clear overcapacity, but Tenaris has been I think successful in segmenting the different market of a geography or a geography and use anti-dumping institutional and trade action to assure a level playing field and containment of unfair trade action in some of the market. This helped in this segmentation of markets in different places. Then segmentation in terms of premium, product differentiation has been very effective in this year to avoid overcapacity spilling into areas in which the oil company exposed to risk and to severe demand for their operation are asking for very reliable supplier. We are really playing on this, and I think we have been successful in this, and we will maintain this drive. And then there is service. If you look at the environment, the competitive environment, no other company has an integration of product and service like Tenaris, and this is something that is also creating a strong differential. How will this be in the future? What we see is that many of our competitors are cash tight from many point of view. They are facing very difficult times. They are losing resources for investment. They are losing resources for accompanying the oil industry in the more demanding product. So, to some extent, Tenaris is the largest player here. Has a positioning that is, from my point of view, not only sustainable, but a position that could be enhanced in the future, independently from the movement of the changes in the results in one quarter or the other. But on the long run, I feel the difference of Tenaris compared to other companies. And this is part of what we want to transmit to you. Premium by consumption. Again, deep water, the premium products are going into this application. Deep water, 16%, shallow water, 22%. This is basically 38%, almost 40% of the premium are used into offshore operation. In this environment of lower price of oil, what we can expect is delay of the new project. So, in the end, we may have a reduction of demand in some of the areas, some of the projects over time. But these projects are projects with a lead time of 10 years, 8 years, 6 years. I don't think will be affected very deeply. Obviously, some of the borderline projects may be postponed for a while. But in general, even in this environment, especially a complex project that are based on a long lead time, should be going on over time, 2000 and from now on. Shale oil and gas are the destiny of some close to 20% of the premium demand of the market. This could be affected in the short term, but in my view, when the oil shales go down, also the gas, the drilling for gas, gradually in the United States should recover slightly, because also part of the gas that gets into the market is gas associated, produced by drilling in oil. To some extent, the more marginal oil drilling are the one that has higher gas content. So a scale down of some of these investments will have an impact also on supply of gas. We expect that drilling for gas should increase, and this component that requires more product able to stand very long laterals and to stand the condition of operation of complex shale gas pressure may increase in the future. In other oil and other gas, there is a very wide range of application. When you look at the weight of shales in the market, we are talking about a very substantial share of the overall demand, 4.3 million on 17 million today. Most of this is API. Here our strategy in the United States, segmentation based on the anti-dumping, the service into this, is the one that should allow us to increase our market share and increase our positioning in this world. As a whole, where are we heading? The company is maintaining a strategy independently from what are the short-term movement in the market. The first statement here is a premium company. We are moving in this direction. I put here some of the elements that they are showing a change on a period of 5 years, between 2012-2017. Within this period of time, the share of heat-treated pipes, heat-treated is an example of high value-added product, is a proxy of the complexity of the mix, is an indicator. We go up from 67% of our total sales to 85% of our total sales. This will be when the new plant in the United States with his heat treatment will enter into operation by the end of 2015 and 2016. Premium, semi-premium on OCTG sales. Again, we move from 55% to 70%. These are high numbers. I mean, are driver of the company. These are driving our sales, are driving to a large extent also our margin. This is has been achieved through investment in R&D, in research and development, in production line, and in all of the technical sale and technical assistance that goes that accompany these sales. Which is the share of sales on a strategic sale? 22 going up to 35. Tenaris is really the leader in supporting development product, production, global reach, service, technical sales, and on-time delivery to the rigs in different situations. This is our differentiation in a world that is not easy to differentiate from the point of view of the pure product. Premium company means a company that is focusing on, in every aspect of our activity, on ambition to excellence. This is our differentiation. Industrial excellence, safety, product development are key for this. The combination of this capability with service are important. This company needs to be number one in the development of product, in the industrial excellence, in the quality of the service, in the ability to measure and transition on issues like the digital requirement of this industry. This is changing. The industry, shales are introducing a change in the culture of how the industry operates in some environment. We should anticipate and accompany and bring to our client innovation on this. We need to, in this sense, I think of Tenaris as a premium company, a company that is able to arrive first even in areas that are not entirely understood by our client, is able to enter and be number one even in uncharted territories. And on this ground, if we talk about the traditional industrial excellence, safety issue that are traditional, there are new things like the ability to accompany service with information technology development. There are also areas in which we think we can establish in the future strong differentiation. Expansion in North America is a key driver. We are investing and we think that North America is represent a large share of the overall worldwide market. We are talking about something in the range of 40% of the worldwide market. So we think that expansion in North America is essential for the position of Tenaris in the future. Global footprint. Gabriel Boskutka will comment on this. No other company has a worldwide presence like Tenaris with operation, manufacturing, service, accessory, finishing, support in so many areas worldwide. Tenaris University. I mentioned this as a tool for integrating a diverse global organization. I think that one of the essential components of our success for the future should be and will depend from our ability to integrate the entire company, to introduce diversity at all level, diversity in terms of nationality, in terms of gender. I mean, the ability of the company to be local everywhere also depends on our ability to transform and to be able to cope with generational change. That is one, is important for us and for our client. We are facing new generation of people in our client, and we need to be able to use our training tool to build this differentiation on human resources based on diversity, sustainable, effective diversity of the company. That's the reason why I mentioned here Tenaris University. I think is a unique tool that we developed in the last 10 years, but it's very is an integral part of our differentiation today. This is what I feel. Investing for sustainable growth is always when the wind change, opportunity arise. Today the market is changing. Some of the pattern of the industries are changing. This is a moment in which a company with a strong balance sheet, a very strong position in terms of cash generation. And with a presence that is really global, could look at the change in the wind, redefine strategy, consider option, and play the game differently in different environment. From my point of view, the turbulence in the market is a stimulus for playing this game differently and look at options that we may have. I would stop here. The CapEx driver that I mentioned here are divided in this slide. Just as a reference, where are we spending today our capital? Well, in maintenance, in maintaining our, renewing our mill, in additional capacity in intermediate process especially. The mix change, that is the focus, is the red part, but it's mix change and additional capacity in some specific area in which we need this, and environment, and work environment, all over work environment and environment care of our mill. This is a very essential component of our way of looking at this business. The excellence and the premium company apply in the relation with the community, the relation with the environment, the relation with the working place. This is something that we have very present and on which we spend important part of our CapEx program every year. I will stop here and start with the round of presentation. Germán, you can
thank you, Paolo.
Follow on it.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you again for coming. And it's very good to be back to the Guggenheim after a while. I'll speak about North America. I'll try to be brief. There's a lot going on these days. I'm sure there are going to be a number of questions. We'll be happy to take them at the end. Very briefly, market context first. I think we're going to be seeing, even through the end of the year, a market demand of OCTG both in the U.S. and Canada at what we call a sustained level. The States is going to rapidly reach, give or take, 6 million tons of apparent demand. Canada will fly at a level of about 1 million tons. These are healthy levels. And the last couple of weeks, I think news most likely than not going to affect that. Now, the important piece, Paolo talked a little bit about it, is the shales component of the demand. In the States, they have reached about 65-66% of the total, and I think it marks a trend that is there to stay. An important aspect we talked about that during the last few quarters is what are the imports dynamics. August the 22nd, we concluded an important trade case. Through the first 9 months, imports remain high. The subject country imports accumulated through the end of September accounted by 1.4 million tons. In the last few months, couple of months, September, October, projected October, we've seen imports from India, Turkey, Taiwan, Vietnam, the Ukraine. They have come down in a considerable level. Korea, though, remains what we consider to be still a high level. Combination of, in our opinion, orders that were already placed, inventory that was already on the ground, vessels that were on the way to the States. Now, together with the rest of the domestic industry, we're watching that. Koreans were, in the end, subject to margins of about 10-15%. But that is associated to a period of investigation that ran between March the 12th through March the 13th. Now, if we were to include what happened after that, in terms of exchange rate changes, etc., we'll see that those existing margins will go up. with monitoring the situation very clearly, and we intend to file a review process when the time comes. Now, in that context, though, we've seen in the last 3 months Pipelogix recovering some of the lost ground. It's been about 6.5% in the last 3 months, and in our view, and all being equal, we would have probably said today the trend will sustain through the end of the year. This adds an element of pricing power regain, which we've been talking about for the last year, is there. We said we lost about 14% in a couple of years' time, recover 6.5% in the last 3 months. Now, in the process, we're preparing. We're preparing, and despite the last 3 or so weeks situation, where we, I think, anticipate a good number of our existing users while they're presently discussing. October, November, we know is budget time, CapEx definition times. And the latest oil pricing situation may introduce some changes to the initially informed views. It's not as we anticipated. It's not unthinkable that we see some of the growth projected for 2015 been adjusted. It's not unthinkable that we lose some of the rigs going forward. But despite that, I think we're preparing in North America, both the U.S. and Canada, to service our existing alliance customers, but as we also stated, to service a portion, very important portion of the market in the States, accounted by, give or take, 25% share. That is servicing the end users which understood or see that imports are no longer an option. And we're doing it touching a variety of different aspects. Number one, we're looking at completing a full range of products. Tenaris in North America has become perhaps the only company that is capable of providing every pipe or tubular solution that the industry requires, from very low demanding welded applications all the way to premium 623 high collapse items which are used on ultra deepwater Gulf of Mexico, where Tenaris has become today the sole source of supply. We're enhancing our industrial system. Bay City continues on. The project is perfectly on track. The weather has not helped much in the last couple of weeks, though. For a couple of years, buried the consequences of a profound drought in Texas. It has rained perhaps 5 inches over the average in the last few weeks. But despite that, the project continues on. It's on track. We worked about 700,000 hours with only one recordable incident, which was not a lost time, but somebody that fell off a couple of feet tall and had an ankle. But overall, the plan continues on. It will be started at the end of 2015. We intend to start threading heat treatment first and finally start up the rolling mill, something which would be up and running by mid-2016 or so. Now, Bay City, though, will play a key role. Integrating our existing premium threading capabilities, welded manufacturing capacities both in Hickman and Conroe, aligning with tubular solutions that are coming from TAMSA and Algoma up in Canada. To ultimately us being able to service our customers with a view that we believe there's no reason for us in the States to service a rig with, give or take, a 5 months' worth of inventory, as industry has historically considered healthy. Yes, the shales are introducing the notion of operational efficiencies and cost control, et cetera, et cetera. And the way we're discussing this with our users is around the notion of total cost of ownership. We believe that there is, in the States, also in Canada, an enormous opportunity to eliminate inventories, eliminate additional inspection requirements, eliminate obsolescence costs, establish a discussion of ultimately not so much what is the price per foot of a given pipe at the Port of Houston, but rather what is the total cost of ownership of that pipe while it's being run on a particular well. Ultimately, the objective is to plant an industrial system product portfolio that is capable also to look at our users and say, we are going to try to synchronize your drilling program to our production programs. The objective is to bill you for the pipe that is run on the well. And for that, we are developing what we call pipe management service bases, as we are replicating what we have done in other countries in the world. In time, Tenaris will be doing just-in-time supply to our wells. Tenaris will be doing accessories, rig returns management, rig preparation work. I think ultimately it is of you that the industry in the States needs to change. Today we're still operating as we have since the mid-80s, and this is where we see the opportunity to, in the end, introduce the new way of expanding our perimeter. With that said, I think I'm going to turn it over to Guillermo. Guillermo Fogel, a member of the board and Vice President of Finance. Thanks, Nico.
Hello. Hello, good morning. Good morning, everybody. It's very nice to be here to see many of you again. I'm going to walk you a little bit through what's happening in Mexico and especially how we see that the energy reform might affect Tenaris moving forward. Here, a presentation in terms of why the energy reform was required and what was happening before the energy reform. As you can see, the oil production that reached a level of almost 3.4 million barrels in 2004 has been gradually declining. By the end of 2013, we were talking about 2.5 million barrels. And today, the last number that I have heard is that Pemex is operating around 2,360,000 barrels. So what was happening is that the fiscal requirement that the country imposed on Pemex was very drastically limiting the capacity to invest. And so the amount of investment that Pemex had, together with what it was able to obtain as credit, was not enough to offset this declining production. And the industry was moving really into a very, very difficult situation that was going to affect also the country. I think that the government was very successful in terms of the modifications that it was able to implement, together with other reforms. I think that the government has surprised us all in terms of the number of reforms and the depth of the reform that has done, especially with the energy reform. And the whole idea was to really create a system where Pemex give more resources to Pemex on one side, but on the other side to allow for private investment on the other that would offset this decline and would enable the government to maintain a certain fiscal income both from Pemex and for the private investment that we're going to done. Here you see same thing was happening with gas. On the gas side, I think the situation was even a little worse because of the prices of gas, the government really reduced a lot, Pemex reduced a lot the drilling for gas and concentrated more on the more profitable oil side. So last year we had really a gas crisis in the country. There was gas shortages for the industry. Sometimes some of the companies had to reduce operations because of this. So gas was an important factor. And even though the country was next to the U.S. with a huge source of gas, there was a big problem with the transportation. And so today it's been resolved. Today we have pipelines that are starting up. The first one, Los Ramones one, is starting up. It was just finished last week. So the country is moving in resolving the gas situation, but this was the main source, the need, and the country needs to get into the energy reform. So what we are seeing is really for a government that is trying to accelerate the times much more than trying to limit the times. In terms of the energy reform, what it consists and how it can affect us, just walking through very fast through the different parts that it's composed. The first one is a reform on Pemex. Pemex has been changed into what is called today a productive state enterprise, which has different different elements. Obviously, there's an element in terms of a change in government, in governance. There's an element that is giving much more autonomy to Pemex in terms of the budget amounts and management decisions. One very important factor is that now Pemex can go into joint ventures with private companies in order to invest. And the fourth one is that there is a change in the fiscal elements for Pemex that is going to reduce gradually the amount of taxes or the government take from Pemex. And this should free up around an amount. And the amount that I'm going to tell you are the official amounts that the government has presented. This is the numbers that the government is using in their presentations. But it's going to end up freeing up around $7 billion for Pemex in a time lapse during the following 4 years, which is going to allow Pemex to invest on its own, this $7 billion. And we are expecting a large portion of that coming into E&P. Secondly, the government set aside certain of the reserves and certain of the fields for Pemex to maintain and to continue operation. And this was called Round Zero. Round Zero, Pemex made a proposal to the government in terms of saying, we would like to keep this for our operation. And this process has finalized. Pemex requested 83% of the 2P reserves. These 83% were granted to Pemex, and so Pemex is going to continue to operate here. From the remaining 70% of the reserves, around 15% have been allocated into, I'm going to go a little bit further ahead, which is called round one. But so the whole 2P reserves are going to be in play in the short term in terms of their exploration. And then in terms of the prospective resources, Pemex has requested and was granted 21% of the prospective resources for future exploration and production, and another 13% was granted on the round one. So today, round one, together with round zero, represent around one-third of the prospective resources, and what we expect is to see more rounds going into the future in order for future exploration. In terms of this 21% and 80% that Pemex is maintaining, there is a change that is happening within the operation of Pemex. The first change is that Pemex had already 22 service contracts that were either already on operation or that were starting to get into operation. The idea is for these service contracts to migrate into the new operation, which is into a profit sharing, into a production sharing, or into a license. This is, I think that this is the only part where we are seeing a little bit of a delay. The original idea was that 11 of these contracts were going to end up this migration by the end of the year, and another 11 by the first half of next year. Now, the idea is that these 22 contracts are going to be migrating finish the process by the end of April. The number that is expected to be invested within the next 10 years is $35 billion, so it's a $3.5 billion per year. To give you a reference, which is a number that all of you know, but to give you a reference, today, the total investment of Pemex in a year has been varying around $23 billion. So are substantial amounts in terms of the activity we are expecting in Mexico. Following with that, when you see also still talking about this part of Pemex, Pemex now, as I mentioned, is going to be able to do joint ventures. And so they're going to farm out what is called farm out, which is they're going to look for partners for working in part of these reserves. They're talking about 14 strategic fields under 10 contracts, which are gonna request or are gonna invite people or companies to invest together with Pemex. the amount of money that is expected to be invested within the next 4 years is $16.4 billion, so we're talking about more or less $4 billion per year. And then we go into what is called the round one contract, which is this is bidding that are going to be open for private investors, for private companies. Pemex can participate within forming a joint venture, or Pemex cannot participate, and this can go to third parties. When we are analyzing this, we're talking about $34 billion, so we're talking about around $8.2, $8.3 billion per year in terms of additional investment. So when you see the impact that this might have within the operation of Mexico that we have, it's a substantial amount. We have to see how successful they are. We have to see if what's the interest. What's happening today with the prices of oil, I don't think that is going to change the appetite of Mexico to move very fast within these contracts. It might change a little bit the appetite of the participants. But this is where we are. And this is the timing of this process. They are dividing this in terms of biddings for shallow, extra heavy oil, Chicontepec and unconventional, onshore and deep water. If, as you all know, Mexico, with the exception of certain areas like Chicontepec, like some of the onshore, is substantially a premium market. So this is very important, and this is good news in terms of the whole Tenalis operation. And as you can see in this graph, they are starting with shallow waters. When we are talking about shallow waters, we're talking about here both the farm outs and both the round one contracts. They're going to be played at the same time, and they expect to assign the contract by the middle of April. Then you go extra heavy oil by the middle of June, Chicontepec and unconventional by July, onshore August, and deep water September. So this is the time that we are seeing in terms of the contracts, in terms of awarding the contracts. What we are expecting in terms of our operation is that we expect some increases in the volume in 2015, but we expect really a much larger jump in terms of the operation starting in 2016 because of this, because of the times of the contracts. And what we are doing is that we're preparing the structure in Mexico so as to be able to offer to the newcomers exactly the same system that we're offering to Pemex. Pemex is not only a just-in-time, but it's a little bit what Germán was talking in terms of how we see now the U.S. market is a whole inventory management system. Pemex has zero inventory. We only collect from Pemex at the time the pipe has been run down. So they don't pay until they use the pipe. We give them the services in terms of problems that, let's say, recovering pipes, etc. It's the whole inventory system. We're doing some investment. We're investing, for example, what Paolo was mentioning on additional heat treatment capacity. So we are preparing the system so that all the newcomers really receive the benefit of the service and of the design of the pipes. And with this, I will turn it to Javier.
Good morning. Okay, so I'm responsible for the southern cone of Argentina. And I'm also head of worldwide sucker rod divisions, which has plants in Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, Romania, and next year, in 2015, a brand new state-of-the-art mill in Conroe, Texas. But being responsible for the southern cone, I will be talking about Vaca Muerta. And Vaca Muerta is the biggest thing in the energy sector that's going on today in Argentina. And I will try to share with you our views on probably the most important question. Will Vaca Muerta happen? Will it grow? And to answer that, I think that first we have to understand how we got here the decisions that were made by policymakers in Argentina and the impact of these decisions. So Argentina in the last decade, I would say, has been conducting a very short-sighted policy with a price setting in the energy sector that were obviously very good for consumers, but very poor to encourage investment in the oil sector in the country. To give you a general picture, in gas in particular, here in this graph you can see the consumption of gas in the country, which has not stopped to grow in this last 10, 20 years. And on the other side, you can see the supply side. In blue, you see the supply of domestic gas, domestic production, and this peaked around 2004 and has come down ever since. Okay. Argentina was once, a decade, 2015, 20 years ago, a net exporter of gas. It became, in only 6 years, a net importer. Argentina is now producing gas domestically and paying oil companies in the country a price that goes from as low as $1 per million BTU to $53 and up to $5 per million BTU. Since this is not enough, it's importing gas from Bolivia at prices in the range of $10 or $11 per million BTU and importing liquefied natural gas in the area of $15, $19. And even importing some liquids in winter time to supply the thermal generation of electricity in the country at prices way above that, 25. And I think that here lies one of the biggest and most important issues. Today, Argentina is importing with all these heavy prices when it has the ability to develop and produce gas in the country at much, much lower prices. To put this into context, look at this other graph here. And Argentina has completed a tough feat, and that is to convert a surplus, an energy trade surplus, in excess of $6 billion into an energy deficit of the same amount, $6 billion. So in a span of time of about 6 years, Argentina lost $12 billion in trade balance, energy trade balance. This has impacted trade in Argentina heavily and is also taking a large toll in the economic situation of the country. On the other hand, I would say that this problem, the issue, the energy issue, is probably the reason why we feel that the solution is coming. This has caused the political constituency in Argentina to become very aware of the problems that the energy sector can cause if it's not addressed properly, and also of the opportunities around this. And we have seen, actually, in the last years, several things, several recent developments that occurred in the country, in the sense that they show that there's an increased political awareness and measures started to be taken. For example, Argentina has adjusted prices for oil in excess of 25% in dollar terms in the last year and a half. A new price for the production of gas was set in place in the area of $7.5 per million BTU, which is a very convenient price to produce gas in the country. A new law is now being passed in Congress, which was presented by the executive branch, passed already through the Senate, and it's, as we are speaking today, being studied in the lower chamber, which addresses also very important issues like setting a more prolonged period of time, concession time, for unconventional exploration, setting a cap on royalties agreed between the central government and the state governors, and eliminating the carry, which was a process that allowed provincial government oil companies to participate without investing on the profits of investing in exploration. So we see some measures that are moving in the right direction. we feel that Argentina inevitably needs to develop this reserves. There's a huge economic imperative behind the development of Vaca Muerta. So I guess that those of you that chose to come today using a subway had a much better time than those of us who chose a taxi. New York City on a rainy day is complicated. The underground is much better than the above ground. There might be a case to be made there, a parallel between New York City in a rainy day and Vaca Muerta. So we talked about the above ground. We're going to go below ground, which is much, much easier, I would say. What do we have below ground? So below ground, we have a large play, which is located in the western part of Argentina. This is some 700 kilometers away from the coast and about 1,000 kilometers from the central industrial powerhouse of Argentina. We have compared here Vaca Muerta with Eagle Ford. It's a surface that it's close to half the size of Eagle Ford, okay, but three times the depth. The difference is the development, of course, of the resource. Argentina is at the very early stages of the development of Vaca Muerta. To put, again, into perspective, Eagle Ford drills about in excess of 4,000 wells per year. Argentina and Vaca Muerta is running at 150. This is 2013 figures. We'll see about 250 wells in 2014. Most of this is driven, without a doubt, by YPF, the local oil company, the national oil company. And YPF undoubtedly operates with the logic of the Argentinian government. The Argentinian government today is importing gas at 11, 15, 19, 25, and is willing to invest to produce gas locally, of course, at any price below that. This is why YPF has been so aggressive in this push. There's a limit to what YPF can do, of course. So you've seen associations there with other oil companies getting in place. And Argentina, without a doubt, needs way more than what YPF can do on its own. So here lies the challenge, in the ability of Argentina to be able to attract and create the conditions to attract all the huge financial investments that need to be brought into the country. A word must be said about other challenges that we have to face. There's a logistical challenge. As I mentioned before, we are 700 kilometers away from the coast. We will need to move, or the industry will need to move, in excess of 3 million tons of product to supply the development of Vaca Muerta. A railroad is there, but it needs huge investments to support this size, the infrastructure in roads, buildings, services is quite substantial. Vaca Muerta is located in a very convenient location. It's basically a desert with no population whatsoever, but with a very large river nearby which can secure the supply of water. But there's a huge challenge of infrastructure to be put in place. Tenaris, without a doubt, has a privileged position to take advantage of Vaca Muerta. The scenarios that we have driven for Vaca Muerta, they will not dent the capacity of our mill in Argentina to supply Vaca Muerta. Our mill there currently is exporting some 75% of its output. And Siderca, our mill in Argentina, will remain a large net exporter after supplying the growth in Vaca Muerta in excess of 50%. We are, in any event, deploying large investments in our mill to secure the value-added products that we want to produce in the mill and to adapt our logistical facilities to supply by railroad the Neuquén operation in Vaca Muerta. We have a large service base in the country, similar to what you heard Memo mentioned in Pemex. We've been servicing the oil company of Argentina for many, many decades now. We have a large yard and service base in the regions, in both the south and in the Neuquén region. And we're actually doubling that capacity to prepare for the future developments of Vaca Muerta. So in short, we feel that there's very powerful reasons to be very confident on the future development of Vaca Muerta. The economic imperative is very, very powerful, and we feel that Tenaris has a privileged position to take advantage of this opportunity. Let me hand it over to Gabriel now.
Thank you, Javier. Morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here. My name is Gabriel Podkupka. I'm based in Dubai, the Emirates, responsible for the East Hemisphere. So for me, it's a pleasure to be stuck in traffic in New York with a rainy day, because rainy days is something that we are not very used to in Dubai. Nevertheless, my life is with a strong team that we have in the East Hemisphere is to cover this vast area. As you can see, it's quite a large, ambitious area to cover. It's very dynamic, lots of challenges, but also lots of opportunities ahead. We have a team of 4,000 employees that support Tenaris in the Eastern Hemisphere. It's a very diverse team, 53 nationalities and growing. We operate in 45 locations between manufacturing facilities, service centers, and offices. So this is offering a lot of opportunities and reach in different parts of the oil and gas fields around the world. As Paolo was saying, safety is one of our key values of the company. Safety is important, and the safety is our priority for these 4,000 employees that are not only working in manufacturing sites, but also going to fields that are in complex areas. We had to deal also with the Ebola outbreaks, MERS outbreaks. We deal with ISIS, and going around that, we have some evacuations in Egypt and Libya. So there is part of our agenda that is business, geopolitics, and also managing a complexity that goes beyond something what we would like to see. The idea is to walk you around very quickly, take a few minutes to go around the main areas. Let me start with Sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa, which has been, as you recall, an area of growth in the Eastern Hemisphere during the last years. This is an area that is characterized with deep waters, complex projects in which we are present. I will highlight the job that our team is doing in Ghana, for example, where we are supporting Tullow 10 and Eni Sankofa, which are the two main development programs going on in Ghana. We have an office in Accra. We have a base in Takoradi, which is the oil and gas hub of the country, local repair shop, service center, technical people supporting the development of that country, just to name one of them. We are supporting also many exploration throughout the continent. There is pioneer exploration in many areas. Pre-salt Angola is the one that has been important, as you saw in our financial figures during especially the first half of this year. But this is not only a space for OCTG. There is also, this is important for deep water pipelines. One of the most complex specifications for deep water pipelines are here in Sub-Saharan Africa. Here we are, for example, right now manufacturing and shipping a pipeline for Total Moho North project in Congo. This is being done in Dalmine, in the manufacturing mill in Italy that Luke is running, that has specialized on deep water pipelines. We just got recently bookings for Kaombo. It's a massive project, the largest subsea project ever in Angola, seamless from Italy. And also, we got the good news this morning that also we will be able to supply also a welded line from our mill in Confab in Brazil. So we are positioning very well in the deep water pipelines in Sub-Saharan Africa. Coating is another area that is active here. We have, besides the premium threading facility that we have in Nigeria, we have a coating facility in One, in Port Harcourt, that we have invested heavily on resources and technically to upgrade the facility to be able to produce the most sophisticated coatings, insulation coating. As a matter of fact, last month we started producing for a project of deep water in Nigeria called Erha North for ExxonMobil. Overall, we have an important setup with different kind of products that have allowed us to grow in Sub-Saharan Africa. The east part of Sub-Saharan Africa is still in exploration phase, but we see potential. The exploration has been very successful. Deep water, it's going to be gas in Tanzania, also in Mozambique, and we have a good relationship with those operators that are leading those explorations that have selected our technology for that initial phase. We'll see when this project will be sanctioned, maybe towards the end of this year or next year, but it's something that we see potential. In the north of East Africa as well, we see potential for oil in Uganda and Kenya. This may be 2-3 years from now, but these are very big reserves that the countries and operators in those two areas are trying to get together, building an important pipeline. We see some potential in Sub-Saharan. If we go to North Africa, history is totally different. The last 3 years has been an area that has been basically down after the Arab Spring, has been an area that has been very, very difficult. Egypt is an area that basically stopped all the exploration activity of gas. The country was exporting gas a few years ago. All the exports were directed to the increasing domestic demand. No investments, IOCs with outstanding debts with the government. The end situation has been blocked. But there are some initial signs. The government paid $300 million last week. And there are some signs that Egypt will come back. There is a huge need of gas. The options are regasification. The options are pipeline for the neighbors. That is not so easy. There is potential there. So we are well positioned with the office in Cairo, the team that we have there, with a service yard in Alexandria to take care if Egypt comes back. And I'm starting to be, for the first time in a long time, a little bit positive on the prospects of Egypt. Libya has been a country that is important for Tenaris, has been with a natural proximity to Italy. So we usually have had an important market share, has been down, especially the onshore. But the offshore is moving. We are serving the offshore part, which is a Eni Mellitah JV in a complex field through Malta, because all the drilling team is supporting the offshore activity in Libya from Malta. So we are taking advantage of that. We are standardizing our supply on Dopeless, which is a product that, due to the sensitivity of Mediterranean, we are promoting all across the area. Algeria is governed also by activity of a national company, similar to the Middle Eastern national companies have their cycles of purchasing. But activity is moving. There are some tenders ongoing that we have been successful. So in 2015, we are going to see a positive rebound on Algeria, supporting, we think, that will be, after 4 years, a little bit of a better North Africa than the one that we used to have in the past. If we go north to the North Sea, this is probably the most sophisticated market that we serve in the Eastern Hemisphere. This is where the most demanding HPHT projects take place. We are supplying there some examples: Jasmine, ConocoPhillips in the U.K., Maersk Drilling and Project in Norway, and this is where we are deploying the new technologies for HPHT. This is an area where we are promoting heavily Dopeless. We see a very good adoption of all our customer base in Norway, U.K., and in Denmark on Dopeless. This allows no dope on the rig site, no dope on the sea, so it saves this environment. And more importantly, now with the cost-cautious approach of the majors in the North Sea, which is an area that is being looked at heavily on the cost, Dopeless has allowed savings in running time. We have done some trials in some runnings with Dopeless, and the saving in running time has been 20% on average. So this is huge, and some of the major oil companies there are migrating fast to the adoption of Dopeless. We are supporting also, this Dopeless needs to be serviced locally, accessories and repairs, so we're increasing our capacity of Dopeless in these fields. If we go to continental Europe, it's a large area. Romania is the largest oil and gas market in continental Europe. This is where we have a privileged position, given that we have a strong manufacturing base. We have a long-term agreement with OMV Petrom, which is the largest player there. We supply all their needs of tubulars. We supply also their needs of saccharides. As Javier commented, we have a manufacturing plant of saccharides. This allows us to have a combined offer of tubing and saccharides that optimize the workover, something that is very important in mature fields. We also have a service center in Ploiești, state-of-the-art service center that allow us, Guillermo was explaining for Mexico, we have the same level of service just in time to the rigs. I mean, 12 rigs, 100 wells per year that we deliver material and we pick up the remnants. It's very integrated. We are even managing the accessories. We're even doing the assemblies of the floating equipment for them. It's a very integrated service level that we have there in Romania. Romania is not only about the mature onshore fields, but there is also some prospects on exploration. Deepwater, Black Sea is moving. ExxonMobil and Lukoil are moving into doing some exploratory wells. There is a big hopes that Romania, that still imports 20% of gas from Russia, will be self-sufficient on gas through these developments, and our technology is there present as well. We continue moving east. We go to Russia. Russia is a very big market, but to a large extent, it's a market that has been using API or simple products that are mainly supplied by the domestic producers. The premium market in Russia is limited, but we are present there. We have an important share of this premium market. The impact of sanctions is limited to two projects that we were supplying, ExxonMobil Kara Sea, one well. We supply the material, but ExxonMobil decided to stop that well. The other one is Eni exploring in the Black Sea, in the Russian side of the Black Sea. Two wells. We had the order and the contract, but seems that the signs that we're getting is that this will be stopped until further notice. Still, the majority of our customer base in the premium space in Russia is not affected by the sanctions. It's not part of the sanctions. Some examples of a gas in Sakhalin, some north part of the Caspian Sea. These are areas that are not influenced by the sanctions. To go down to the Caspian. The Caspian for us, the number one market there is Kazakhstan. It's a country where we have been present for more than 10 years. We supply there the two main active oil fields, which are Karachaganak and Tengiz. These are very complex areas with high severe components. We have a presence in Aksaay and a presence in Atyrau to serve this contract. We have decided to invest in the country further, and we are launching a premium threading facility that we will open during the beginning of 2016. This will be in Aktau, which is a natural logistic hub. This is also an area that we are moving. Local content is important in many countries and in Kazakhstan also. We are moving in that direction. We go to Asia Pacific, the big area. We have a distinctive industrial setup, manufacturing in Japan, manufacturing in China, manufacturing in Indonesia. There is no other player that has this combination that gives flexibility and efficiency to the supply of this area. We are participating in the complex areas, for example, Tarim in China. This is far west China, close to Urumqi. This is a field of HPHT, very complex, using corrosion-resistant alloy material that we produce in NKK in Japan. We ship to China, and in our facility in China, in Qingdao, we're able to finish and then service in the well with our technical team locally there. We participate also in the deepwater activity further south, for example, in some of the LNG. Wheatstone is a project operated by Chevron for the LNG there in Australia. We supply that material, again, supply of corrosion-resistant material coming from NKK. Indonesia is moving. There is some potential in deepwater, not moving at the pace that we would like, but there is also some potential, and we are evidently with the local content manufacturing, well-positioned to take advantage when this occurs. Let's go back to the center, to Middle East, which at the end is the largest market in the Eastern Hemisphere. And here, it is very clear that we see growth in drilling activity. We have been, as Pablo was saying, reviewing in detail with the majority of the national companies. This is a space mainly driven by national companies, Saudi Aramco, Kuwait, and the operating companies of the ADNOC Group in UAE. And there is a big increase in search, mainly for gas. There is a big need of industrialization, a big need of domestic demand, so they are going for gas in a very aggressive way. There is also the depletion of oil that is there. Complexity of the new fields is also demanding more demanding products. So there is also part of the activity that is driven by oil depletion. These are complex areas. The sour service of Saudi, I think we talked about this in the past. There is HPHT in Kuwait. This is a deep drilling, complex wells. In UAE also, there is sour service environment. They also have new techniques of drilling. They are building artificial islands to arrive to certain areas. Their wells are with laterals that could arrive even beyond 30,000 feet. They need torque. They have selected the wedge Dopeless as the main technology that will allow them to get the necessary torque to arrive to those targets. So there we are well positioned, and we expect this to continue to grow. This is activity. As Pablo said, Aramco recently celebrated 200 rigs a couple of weeks ago. They are targeting 230 rigs in the next couple of years. So this is really moving. But then we need to understand, and also I think it's important you to understand, that the nationals buy with cycles that are not necessarily in line with the drilling activity. They have destocked in 2012, restocked in 2013, reducing second half of 14 inventories, and we expect this to continue to happen for the majority at least of 2015. So activity is going up, but we expect the resumed shipments to Saudi in a big level like we had only at the end of 15 or 16. So it's something that is not happening as anticipated in the short term. On the other hand, UAE and Kuwait have destocked during this year. We expect increase in line with the increase of activity in shipments in 2015. So in a way, to some extent, Kuwait and UAE will have a positive purchasing cycle during 2015. This is an area that we differentiate on products. The complexity of the area as well requires support. Some of these nationals do not have the same level of expertise for these new areas that they, like the IOCs, the large majors, have. So we are constantly at their sites, working with them, assuring in the material selection, in the running of the tubulars, that we are close to them. And local content in Saudi, as we discussed, is important. We have a facility that is up and running, achieving good level of excellence, and we are investing in a second facility that we will open at the beginning of 2015 that will be up and running. So our setup and our industrial content offering for Aramco and the kingdom is moving. Just to close, I will talk back to the deepwater, which is something that we touched through the different areas, not so active in the Middle East, but in the rest. And this has been a key area of focus for us, has been growing at an important pace. You can perceive already that the pace of growth in 14 is a little bit less than the years before. The capex of the majors in the international space compared to last year has been announced as flat, revised down. So there is a little bit of a cost-cautious approach. So we will see, we don't see rigs coming down on existing developments, but we need to understand how decisions are made for new developments going forward. Not all deepwater projects are not economical at $85 or $90 barrel. Not all. Still, there are many that are within the band, but it's something that we will need to look and see. Still, well integrity is a must. This is an area where they're mainly dominated by majors. They don't take risks. After Macondo, the world changed on this. So well integrity is a priority, and we have the new products that are coming tested to the new protocols and standards to assure this well integrity. But also we are have an offering on cost efficiency, working capital efficiency, Dopeless, discussed, produce savings in running time, and also we can optimize the supply chain to be able to lower the burden on the majors, having an efficient supply chain. And last but not least, technical support. The majors have an expertise in deepwater, but we are present in every deepwater field in the world, so we are also assisting them, sharing information and knowledge as they design the new wells of tomorrow from the string design, and also heavily supporting when the material is run, so they get really the value of the expensive tubulars that they pay. Okay, so with this, I'll turn it over to Luca, and we're happy to take questions later on. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm Luca Zanotti. I'm the European Area Manager, and I'm responsible on the commercial side for the sales of what we call the industrial products and what we call the products for the engineering. I will come back this to explain a little bit more what I'm talking about. But at the same time, also responsible of our operations in Italy. Our operation consists of five plants that goes under the name of Tenaris Barmia. But being my first time here, I will spend just two words on what we do from the commercial side. When we talk about industrial products, we're talking about a wide array of different products. We may go from the mechanical pipes sold to the engineering construction industry, which are the more commoditized products sold through distributor usually, to the most sophisticated application in the automotive business, such, for example, tube components for side impact airbags, and going through very sophisticated application in the hydraulic components for earth-moving machines. So you understand that the complexity, I mean, of this space. When we talk about engineering, we're mainly talking about two businesses, what we call HPI, hydrocarbon processing industry. So we're talking about downstream. Here we're talking about petrochemicals. We're talking about refineries and gas processing plant. And then in the power gen, we're talking about, of course, power generation. So having said this, I think that the question I need to answer here is how we contribute to Tenaris differentiation from our standpoint. And to answer this question, I need to go back to 2009, where the deep economic downturn left Europe with a shrinking local domestic demand and with the unsolved problem of high production costs. So what did we do? Basically, we worked around this three axes. So we try to reposition our commercial offering on higher-end niches on the one side. The second axis was related to the search for efficiency, for productivity gains, and the third was the refocusing of our R&D. Going briefly through this, product line reposition, what does this mean? Basically, here the idea is different by each segment. In the industrial segment, what we did is to try to leverage our know-how to pursue higher-end niches linked mainly to the energy business, which is, in the end, Tenaris' core business. Examples. For example, we developed mechanical pipes that are used in well completion, for example, for the production of manufacturing of oil tools using well completion. Or another example, we leverage our knowledge in civil engineering structural pipe to pursue offshore structures. And I could go ahead for 2 hours, but I don't think that it's the case. So I will move straight to the HPI. In the HPI, I need to go back to what has already been said different times, to the service component. We develop a service component by analyzing the process of the engineering companies when they go from the front-end engineering to the post-erection time. And we did try to minimize cost. And so we go back to the total cost of ownership concept and to share these cost gains with our customers. This, of course, help our customers to gain capital efficiency. EPCs and end users are always eager of capital efficiency, and us to differentiate from the low-end European production and from the Japanese, the Chinese competition. And on the power gen, we developed a unique product offering for the fast-growing gas-fired power generation segment. By doing this, as you can see, we were able to move our product mix in Dalmine from 50% in high-end to 70% in high-end in four years. Now, moving to the second axis, which is related to to efficiency gains. Here we worked on a multi-year investment plan that you can see there. We were investing for 4 years between 60 and 100 million. To do what? Mainly to specialize our production facility. So now in Italy we are specialized on heavy wall restricting tolerances line pipe that then we provide all over the world. We are specializing ourselves on large, premium large diameter casing, and again, we are the sole supplier that can provide 26 meter length tubes for the construction of some components in the power gen industry. By doing this, we've been able to raise by 20% our productivity when we measure productivity as revenue per employee, which position ourselves well above the European average. The third and last axis was related to R&D. In this respect, we've been able to focus our R&D efforts on lamination processes. And by doing this, of course, we rationalize this, and we've been able to produce know-how that can now be leveraged throughout the entire Tenaris footprint. This is basically it for me, and I will leave the stage to Edgardo Carlos, our CFO.
Thank you, Lucas. Good morning, everybody. I'm very glad to be here back in New York. I am Edgardo Carlos, Chief Financial Officer of Tenaris, based in Houston. For the sake of time, I will try to be very, very short, so we have plenty of time for Q&A. But basically what I would like to touch today is that all the things that have been said so far, I mean, all the deployment of resources and the strategy that has been combined in Tenaris worldwide bring a clear and sustainable financial position consistent in the many years that we have been running. As you can see in here, the trend of our free cash flow clearly is a sort of a unique in the industry. I mean, we have been outperforming many other peers, not only in the tubular business, but also in the oil services, which we try to compare basically in here, in which we try to measure how our profitability margins, measured in terms of EBITDA ratio, and how much of the earnings of the company are translating into a free cash flow. So you see that leading this table is Tenaris basically with Schlumberger, in which in our case, in the last 2 years, we have been basically turning more than 100% of our earnings into free cash flow, while then you see some others probably going down the road to the left and down, and very much down the road our main competitor in the tubular business. This has been a consistent achievement of Tenaris in a different kind of environment that we have been facing. I mean, the footprint that we have been showing with Gabriel, with Guillermo, Herman, that sometimes we have headwinds that affected some regions are very much compensated with the dynamics in other regions. So this helped us to some extent, maintain a very healthy profitable ratio in Tenaris. And that's why we end up, after some acquisition in 2012, to be able to increase significantly our cash position. I mean, today the company is in a position in which our cash exceeds our total debt approximately by $1.5 billion. In terms of the return to investment, to the investor and shareholders, basically, Tenaris, as you can see here, we have been able to increase by 25% our total dividend paid from 2010 to 2013, even in the period in which our net income remained pretty much the same. So means that the payout ratio of Tenaris has been moving from 30% to 35%-36%. Coming back to the comment of Paolo at the very beginning, the current position of Tenaris, especially at the moment in which we see some turbulence in the market, is a very key differentiation in terms of continue deploying the strategy that we have been mentioning, going local to many other places, increasing our capacity, reaching services to the customer that clearly demand working capital and many other resources, but at the same time, be able to go forward for any potential in consolidation or increase in our activities that consider us even in a more leader position as we are today. With that, Paolo, I will leave you.
I think we can close here the presentation. We exceeded by some 50 minutes as a whole, but I think it's not too bad. I hope you have a vision of a company that is a leader and different from any other in our space, focused on differentiation with a very wide global positioning, able to withstand short-term movement because we have been able basically to, I think, overcome a big increase in the capacity in our space in the last six, 10 years. We are doing this, maintaining our profitability, thanks to a deep differentiation and segmentation of our presence. This is the image that we want to transfer, and also we want to send the message that the company has many engines, many diversified engines. Some of these engines have huge potential. We saw North America, we saw Argentina, we saw Mexico. We perceive the positioning in Southeast, well, better in Middle East, the strongest position, I think. Some engine is, I would say, idle, like could be our position in some of the country like Brazil or Venezuela. We are confident that over the future, if you look at the company, you can perceive the strength coming from this different engine and from the premium differentiated high value-added component that is growing into the company. Let's stop here, and I would open the floor for any question that you may have to anybody. I will direct your interest. Please. We have microphone here.
Yeah, if I could just ask two questions. One on costs. I was wondering how you're seeing your cost position right now, cost trends, with the difficult environment that we're in with a lot of foreign exchange fluctuations, other costs, how you're seeing the competitiveness of the plants, and how that affects your business. Secondly, you're obviously in a very comfortable cash position right now. The world is a difficult place. There may be opportunities to expand your business via acquisition or some other activity. I was wondering how you're seeing that opportunity as you look out over the next one to two years.
Very briefly, on the cost side, I think that basically in this moment, we are enjoying lower price of iron ore. We should enjoy. Obviously, this is getting into our balance sheet with time now because it's not immediate. We should have relatively low level of cost of scrap over time. The investment done in our facility in the last 5 years are continuously improving the efficiency. We are also part of the investment being substituting capacity. We closed a mill in Italy, we closed two mill in Italy, we closed other segment in Italy. We substitute a much more efficient facility. In the end, if I look at Tenaris from a cost point of view, we should be leader in cost in complex product. We are not talking about the very pure, simple product on which the manpower could be very effective. In our case, I frankly do not see a threat coming from that side. Cost should be well-positioned. As far. Yeah, please. No, please feel free.
Yeah, in terms of the effect, you were mentioning basically almost 80 to 90% of our revenues are dollar-based, and our facilities are in the places in which the currency has been deteriorating or devaluating against the dollar. So, competitively speaking, now with the yen, the euro, and the real, we have been in a much better position in terms of cost, besides the raw material aspect. So this is...
Yeah. This is a large company, obviously we can have from Argentina, from this. I mean, different regional scenario could present cost issue or tax issue. Basically, I do not see a threat from that point. When you talk about our, how we look at investment, we look at all the engine that Tenaris have in the different situation, and we see how by organic growth, by acquisition, we could enhance our differentiation. With this, we are looking at opportunity, and we think that, as I was saying at the beginning, some turbulence, some change in the wind could open up space for us in strengthening regional product, service aspect that could strengthen our business. Yes.
Good afternoon. During Gabriel's presentation, he talked quite a bit about a lot of services in addition to supplying the OCTG and to line pipe. Can you give us an idea in the other regions as well how you view service revenues and how that can affect the overall margin and profitability of the various regions, please?
If you understand, if I understand right, is the question is how the service could enhance margin in this. It's very clear. I mean, I think that the company, oil company, are facing a big challenge in large project, in realizing the project on time and cost. Now, some of the company are using acquisition purchasing processes based on tendering. Some other, and in a growing number of other, are perceiving that partnership with a strong supplier, quality-oriented, performance-oriented, industrial excellence, with capacity of product development, are the right way to reduce the time to market of project, to reduce, to make more predictable the results of the project, and to be more effective and take decision later in some of the technical aspects. We play on this. On this, we can separate from competition in different market, because we are basically offering a wider range of value added. This is important. Tenaris has a 26 EBITDA ratio, 26% EBITDA ratio. This is strong, and we are maintaining this in a market that is very competitive. We do this by promoting this way of working. Now, in my perception, this is perceived as increasingly important from the point of view of the oil company, because the delay, the overrun, and the problems in project many times depends from the kind of relation with the supplier. It's very clear in a large project offshore or in a refinery, in which to do tendering you need to do the entire basic and detailed engineering. It takes a lot of time. Then you have a process of tendering. Then you have the assignment of the craft and so on. If you work closely in a partnership, you can build faster, more efficiency. An example of this is Kaombo. The case of Kaombo is the largest offshore project ever. Really, the level of integration between ourselves, contractor, supplier, is, from my point of view, changing, introducing a very effective way of pursuing complex project. And so in this sense, I think we are the partner for the industry. Yes, Ole.
Thank you. I wonder whether we could get a little bit more clarity around the timing of the new work in Mexico, because we got the very clear chart there. Then we had starting off with the shallow water, and I think the dot was March. When does that dot translate into contract awards for you on increased drilling?
Yeah. I want to have the perception of this timing as to Guillermo to give you a better feedback. But the important message here is today Pemex is spending in exploration and production around $25 billion. We look at all these numbers. There will be a point in which Mexico will spend almost double this amount. When is your question? Answer?
Guillermo, give us a clear roadmap now on how that builds.
Guillermo could tell us how fast the government could bring us there. Timing, Guillermo.
No, well, I think only that we're going to be seeing gradually, we're going to start to see the migration, and I think migrations, we're going to start to see some effects by the second half of next year. We don't expect anything in terms of round one, let's say, or the farming out. We start to see farming out by 2016, and we are, from the modeling that we have done, if the times are respected the way they are seeing, I think that we're going to see, you know, an increase in orders in 2016, which is going to be a little bit of a mix of the round one and of the farms out. And from there on, I think we're going to see a continuous increase. But as you can see, the bidding, the assignment of the contracts is going to start April 2015, and then it's going to go all the way up to November.
And what does the assignment of the contract exactly entail? Is that when the award?
It's the award.
So I would imagine
the data rooms are being opened already by the Comisión Nacional de Hidrocarburos. The bidding, the first draft of the bidding, the structure of the bidding should be ready in weeks, in four, you know, 3-4 weeks. This is what the people is expecting, and the process is going to start. Is going to start from there.
And what is your impression so far from the kind of the vibe in Mexico about the eagerness of, let's say, local capital to participate in some of these?
I think we have seen, you know, a very keen interest in terms of groups in Mexico and also of foreign investors. I think that I just participated in a congress in Cancun a couple of weeks ago, and I was impressed because we had people there from over the world, both nationals and oil companies participating. I think that we are still missing one factor, which is the government take. What is really what the government is expecting, and I think the two variables that today are going to determine, you know, what the hunger for Mexico is, what's going to be the government take, and obviously this thing about the pricing that might change a little bit the dynamics of the process, from the demand side. But in terms of today, people that are seeing Mexico as a stable country and as an unexplored country where there might be a lot of opportunities, I perceive that there's a lot of interest, generally speaking, both internally in the country and outside of the country. It's my perception.
Thanks. Just one follow-up on prices. This was a topic that was not really talked about, and I understand why, of course, but is there anything you can say about pricing trends in your industry at the moment? We can see PipeLogix, that's a reflection on some oil business lines, but can you kind of elaborate a little bit more? You talked about costs, but how are prices trending at the moment?
Yeah. One final comment on the question of Mexico. I think in 3, 4, 5 years, we should imagine the drilling ship operating for closing the Perdido area, full deployment. Mexico has an advantage, the low cost, the cost of offshore operation is probably going down. There are opportunities for companies to explore in an area that they know with cost that could be contained in a country that is willing to promote this. You combine this, for Tenaris is important. We are preparing base for serving this. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. It could take time, but we will see offshore also, not only offshore. Second point on price. Well, we recovered, have you seen on the price logic, our pricing power after, thanks to the anti-dumping, the level playing field we are creating in the United States. Pricing power is going up again. Now, the turbulence of this week are creating uncertainty. No doubt it's difficult to evaluate now how the shale drilling will react to the perception of the changes in the table and in the supply of oil, volume and quality, in different things. I don't think it's easy to say today, if the pricing power we're recovering, where will we be in June 2015 in the United States. Now, if you talk about globally, in the area in which we are operating, a lot of premium, a lot of region, I do not see a substantial change compared to where we are today. The American price is an important driving factor for formulas. This is affecting the market, usually some way. So U.S. pricing is very important. We recover something. It's difficult to see if we can continue to recover much more or where we are heading in the coming months. It will depend from the reaction of the operator to the existing situation. What we know is that we should be a factor for reducing the cost of our client in the U.S. through service, product, and assistance, preserving the level of price or enhancing the level of price that we can have. I don't know if you remember. I mean, I think it's okay. If there are other points, we will get back on this. Please.
Hi, good morning. Andrea Scauri from Mediobanca. I have a couple of questions. The first one, again, on prices. Anti-dumpings are working, if I understood correctly, on prices, but not on imports, because imports are still coming from Korea. I'm wondering if you are expecting an additional revision to the Department of Commerce on the duties approved last July. And second question, looking at the current scenario that you have described today, you expect next year, 2015, to be a growth year in terms of profitability in absolute terms, or there are still some missing points to see growth in 2015, assuming stable scenario as it is today? Thank you.
Well, I will take the second question first. It's difficult to evaluate now the impact of this change in price of oil. When the WTI stay around 80, there will be impact. It's difficult to evaluate now. I think we will be waiting for the meeting of the OPEC on the 28th of November. We will be waiting for the reaction to understand how deep is this repositioning of supply. I don't think it's easy today to have a clear view. What we see is some impact is there. The change in prices is delaying. No? The combination is delay of some project, destocking of some, so reduction in apparent demand, some suspension of some point. This is affecting, will affect also this quarter. And the next, we will probably be slightly below what we have said in this, following what we have seen in the market. If we will look at 2015. We have to see, but basically the engine that they're getting in, Argentina, Mexico, I think are a factor. And the Middle East should be, at the end, by the second half of 2015, we perceive that we will have some drive in the second part of 2015. And other engine also should get in, probably compensating some weakness we may have affected by the present level of price of WTI and Brent. But on the question of pricing impact in the United States, Germán.
Let's say, speaking on the Korea point you mentioned, Korean imports through October are flying at levels of about 100,000 tons, which again are high relative to the dumping margins, But again, remember the case was finalized August the 22nd, and there's a lead time from Korea that takes not less than 120, 180 days. So there was a lot of things going on well before, I think, the DOC first in July. I think surprised a good number of importers with final determination finding margins and the ITC confirming injury late August. Two things are true. Number one, prices in the States back to biologics, what we're doing, what we're negotiating, have not increased anywhere near 15% dumping margin assigned to the Korean. And two, between March the 13th, say, through March the 14th, the exchange, local exchange rate relative to the dollar has moved in a way that translates on very broad numbers. Additional dumping margins of about 10%. Now, there are formal statutory times. The process or the review process could only be filed a year after the final determination of the DOC. This is July next year. We're monitoring this. Users are aware about this, and ultimately, as industry, we intend to react.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, just looking at Argentina, you sound quite optimistic about the ramp-up potentially in 2015. I'm just wondering how you're seeing that over the next 2 to 3 years, given and how you would compare that to the ramp-up in the U.S. Argentina obviously has not done anywhere near the work, some of the initial work that was done in the U.S., but it benefits from a lot of the what was learned in the United States. How quickly you think Argentina can really monetize the asset?
It will not be anytime near this. What we assume is that YPF is following a course of action determined by the level of financial resources that they can get. So to the extent to which YPF could finance the project, they will go on. In the interest of the country, in the interest of the company, they have also the better appraisal of their area. They know better, they are, let's say, advanced in understanding the play. Other private companies are doing appraisal, understanding the technology and the potential, and trying to determine and define the right technology to lower the cost. Argentinian costs are higher than U.S. costs. This is something that is a concern and affects the profitability of the wells in the full oil area, in the gas rich, and in the gas area. Also, price for gas are, after the low will be higher. So, the company are working on the technology, the appraisal, cost reduction envisaging. In some moment, they will start. YPF will start with systematic pad drilling, high productivity, low cost drilling. They are doing it now. So they will go on. There will be but it's one company with financial resources still limited. Over time, 2016 and on, I think other companies. Independent or other international company will get in with more level of drilling and so. But if you tell me, could we expect 1,000 wells instead of 250 of today? When? I frankly think that by 2018-19 it should be very logical for the country to be able to reach that level of drilling. Now, many things could work for the good or for the bad.
Thanks. My question is for Germán. Germán, I was hoping maybe you could spend a little bit of time talking about thoughts on the U.S. market in 2015. I know we've talked about the PipeLogix pricing moving up, and we've got the effect of the imports. I guess what I'm trying to understand is we think about margins in the U.S., specifically for Tenaris. My understanding is that you probably have
an even mix between seamless and welded currently right now in terms of your U.S. sales? And you made a comment earlier about taking, you know, I guess some share of the import market that gets voided here, if you will. But when we look at that data, what we see is a welded percentage that's significantly higher than that split, closer to like 85% of volumes are actually welded, which I would believe would have a lower EBITDA margin associated with it than what you do on the seamless side. So how do we think about higher volumes as you fill that import void, given that it's more welded content, and how do we think about the margin mix associated with that in the U.S. for you?
I think, Bill, what we're looking at is actually three different layers. True imports, the 1.5 million tons of what we call the subject imports, have been primarily from Korea and therefore welded. Now, but you've seen imports at a level of 3 million tons. And we are not only looking at, say, the notion of replacing subject imports, but imports overall. So it's not said that we would only pursue the big component of the welded piece that is now subject to an anti-dumping. Now, the point is, how do we do it? And I think it ties back to the question of Amy. The rationale we're looking at is the U.S. continues to operate with 5.5 months worth of inventory. This is give or take 3 million tons of OCTG on the ground. This is how the market has been operated since the 80s. And we frankly feel that given that the nature of shales, nature of the market has fairly much established the standard string design. This is a 4.5, 5.5 liner, et cetera, et cetera. There is a clear opportunity of replicating what we've done in places like Argentina, Mexico, and elsewhere, where we simply don't look at price on a per dollar per ton basis, but rather work with our alliance customers, users, and look at aspects of total cost of ownership. The opportunity is ultimately us eliminating aspects of the supply chain that today, in that area of about 300 or rather 500 miles away from Bay City, where give or take 50% of the U.S. apparent demand takes place, there is where we feel we planted in a way that lead us to conclude that there is a intermediation, obsolescence, working capital inventories, string designs that change that require, therefore, the notion of burning inventories out. That needs to be changed. That will change, and we're working on that. That would, in the end, allow us to select to an extent what is the client, the target, the mix, what are the level of inefficiencies where we work to an extent, cap them, eliminate. And then the question becomes, how do we share the advantages we create with our end users? That's what we're working on.
If I could ask one follow-up, is there a specific percentage of volumes of OCTG sales outside of the U.S. that are tied to PipeLogix pricing?
Sure. PipeLogix is entering into the formulas in many of the Latin American, and the formula of the Metin International Oil Company is one component. Usually, it's not the only component. There is one component, PipeLogix, one component could be related to cost. So the formula-driven contracts are moving with the PipeLogix. These kick in slowly because you have renewal every 3 months, every 6 months. Some company has threshold. We adjust only if 3% or 2% above. I mean, there are a different package of four. But basically, the concept of partnership with major drive the question of formulas, because partnership with the company, long-term contract, anyway needs to have a check on price, and this usually is done through formula that include PipeLogix. I wouldn't say which percentage is strictly directly driven, but is a not irrelevant share. Yes.
The Saudi tonnage relative to the seamless average at Tenaris, how does the either revenue per ton or profitability compare?
No, sorry, could you repeat? I didn't understand.
Sure. The tonnage that you sell in Saudi Arabia relative to the seamless average for Tenaris, how does that compare either from a revenue per ton or a profitability perspective?
What we sell in Saudi Arabia today are very complex products. Sour, high collapse, in an environment in which the quality requirement of Saudi are very strict. And are basically material that is going basically for gas complex application. No doubt, these are segment of very high value added for us. So they have a higher margin than other product that are much more, let's say, less differentiated product. So for us, it's very important. For instance, Saudi was last year having, have you seen in the inventory build-up, there is a very extraordinary demand for Saudi that is now transforming to a destocking, so in reduced demand. We will have, for instance, I think this quarter, almost nothing, no? Smaller than we used to be, and you see the impact. It's important.
And then just another question. In terms of the growth in API and the growth in premium, you guys showed, I guess, the last 5 years, that's been 5% growth and 10% growth on the demand side. Are those good numbers to assume going forward?
We were always looking ahead in a stable environment with something in this range, 5%, 10%, 8% for premium. Now, in an environment in which the overall level of growth in the market for the next 2015 at least will go down, it's more difficult to have a forecast. If I should look 3, 4, 5 years from now, I would confirm it. If you tell me what is happening in 2015, I would expect the API demand to be more affected in the present circumstances than the premium differentiated product. Because usually, the premium differentiated is associated to projects that have a long lead time and do not stop for a change, short-term change in the price of oil, of gas. So, in my understanding, the two number will be lower, but the API will be affected more by by an expectation of long-term WTI at $80. If this is told into the mind of the oil company, they will program the CapEx and their cash flow accordingly. And they will cut, in my view, more on some of these projects that require low-end material. No.
Could you give us an update in terms of what you're seeing, you know, in regards to new U.S. capacity? There's been a lot of projects that have been announced. Any sense of what the magnitude or timing of that could be, and to the extent that you think it will impact or not impact your business in North America?
You are mentioning LNG project in the United States.
Yeah, new OCTG capacity that would be coming in the United States.
Capacity. No, sorry. Capacity. Well, if you look at the different project for capacity, I think there is the project of Bay City that will come into 16, on stream in 2016 is unique and very separate from all of the rest. The main project are Benteler with a new seamless pipe mill that is mainly focused on automotive mechanical material. And, you know, Bentley is not a player in OCTG, so it's a player that is not directly focused on OCTG. They didn't have this orientation and know-how, so I don't think that this will be a direct competitor. There is a project of TPCO in Texas. Also, it's difficult for TPCO to get to compete with us. Also, there is no steel shop, rolling mill will come, I think, later, if I'm understanding. So in the end, it will not be easy to get it as a direct competitor. There are some projects in welded, but I think these are competing in a space that is not so directly the same on which we are moving. So I think the most important driver here are the continuity of drilling in oil shales and in some moment the pickup of drilling for gas. We expect that in the next 3-4 years, drilling for gas will resume to some extent. And this will be a very important driver for Tenaris and is a very important driver for Bay City. There are LNG projects getting on stream. There is demand of gas, incremental demand for petrochemical use and so on. I think over time, it's true that there is a lot of gas in the U.S., but over time I think that also drilling for gas will get, and in that space I do not see competition coming in. Yeah, please.
On Benteler and to a certain extent on TPSU as well, we shouldn't forget they are limited for range because Benteler is not by any means capable of covering the entire space that we are covering with our product range.
The plant in Benteler is the one that they are building is limited to 4.5.
So not even able to cover all the mechanical application range.
It's logical. I mean, seamless are made of many large investments. You cannot solve a problem with wind plant. You need wide range. And it's very different. You know?
Other.
Perhaps
you can also the comment that capacity aside, which local industry has not very so far, successful at implementing. TPCO announced the investment in 2008. They have not started the threading lines yet. But the point being is 1.4, 1.5 million tons of imports are today subject to an existing trade order. And I didn't say it when somebody asked me, but when and if the Department of Commerce were to find new duties during the review process, those new duties would apply retroactively to imports made immediately after the initial order. This is back to then August 2014. That has historically acted as, if you will, the most important element for importers to be very cautious because the existing 15%, as far as Korea is concerned, is ultimately not final. If the revision were to be higher, the higher value would be applied retroactively to imports done as of August 2014.
And this put pressure on price, no? To cover themselves. Please.
Thank you. Can you please talk a little bit about your expectations for the difference between the premium priced products and API products? Do you expect this pricing to diverge over time?
We never give precise figure of this because every situation, every engine, as I say, has different condition and different competitive environment. There are areas in which we compete directly on premium with Valoreco, Sumitomo, for a client that are, let's say, very open to the different technology, Tenaris technology or VAM technology, in which we may have tough competitive environment, and there are environments in which even more simple product because of the strength of our logistic is able also to capture a relatively higher margin. So it's true that we have on general on premium the numbers that you have seen, 70% of our sales will come from premium. You can imagine in 2017 that an even higher share of margin will come from premium. This is for sure 70% of sales of CDG, higher level of margin coming from premium, but I wouldn't give a precise number for this.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, if there are no other questions, let me thank you very much. I hope that this format took a little more time than anticipated, but I hope it's been interesting from your point of view also to get to know, interact with a large segment of our management team. So thank you very much, and we proceed upstairs. Thank you.